America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. How comfortable do you feel when you're in another country, or even parts of our own which have their own traditions, which might seem unusual to you? It may even be a challenge at times to communicate to another American of a different generation. What do we have in common? What experiences can we share? Well, more and more cultural agility is going to be a requirement going forward as America becomes more diverse and as we have business dealings with people in other countries who have different languages and customs, which will affect our dealings if we don't school ourselves before we make contact. And in the wake of the pandemic, we may find that more and more of our colleagues live in faraway places. The days of others bending to the American way are over. How do we become more culturally aware? You'll need to. Let's discuss it today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Professor Paula Caligiuri, and she has written a book called Build Your Cultural Agility, The 9 Competencies of Successful Global Professionals. Now, you don't have to be a global professional to really appreciate the next conversation, because I think, Paula, in the context of our own society, there is an awakening, some would call it being a little more woke, to the needs, the aspirations, the history, the culture, so that we can better appreciate the person who's coming toward us to have a conversation.
I would agree, Larry, and thank you for having me on your show. I believe now more than ever, we are respecting the fact that even though people are demographically similar, we still come into any meeting, any conversation, any interaction with a life history of things that have socialized us in our reality. So I'm really excited about this book and its meaning for our country and our world today.
Well, I think it was so important that you stated early on that most people think of culture as only something experienced when you're in another country or interacting with people from another culture, but that's not true. I mean, I think about it from the standpoint of age differences. And when we talk about organizational cultures and how you blend the millennials with the baby boomers, because our milestones are totally different. I'm a boomer. So when I say John F. Kennedy and what he meant to my generation, they look at you and say that was ancient history.
And it's interesting. So I'm technically considered an old Gen Xer. My 4 older siblings were all baby boomers, so I was raised a bit more like a baby boomer. So if you think about just that sentence or that expression, those were two socializing agents, my family, my generation, your generation, you named, you know, organizational culture. Basically, any situation that has a socializing effect on us shapes our values, shapes how we see the world, shapes the lens through which we interpret people and situations. It's so critical that we respect all of those things, right? Not just national boundary.
Oh, yeah. But historically, going overseas, as I have a number of times, there is a sense, Paula, am I wrong, that we, the ugly Americans, as we used to be called, thought that we had a certain chauvinism in terms of our culture, that we were decidedly number one in the world, we had the best economic system, we were socially more liberal, and I'll use that in the small L sense, that we expected everyone to bend to American values and culture. But I don't think that's necessarily the case as much today.
Definitely not. I think Americans, this is going to be such a horrible sweeping generalization, but just my sort of observation from working internationally, and it sounds like yours as well, we are thought of a bit more kind of naive, if you will, about kind of the nature and way that cultures differ, or political histories differ, and like, in part because our country is so large, we can do an awful lot without ever leaving our border. Whereas many other countries around the world, you know, their kind of comfort and understanding of national differences is a little bit greater. But I would say a lot of what that old ugly American kind of post World War II perception was is dissipating. I think if anything, we have to kind of work a little harder to get our reputation back up there again.
Are you surprised that there are so many Americans, honestly, now, not just the pandemic, which has made a lot of things more difficult, but Americans in general, a lot of them don't have passports or thought about leaving America.
Right. And, you know, I don't have a strong, this is going to sound shocking for somebody who spent my career writing about what makes people effective living and working internationally. And I will tell you that just because someone spends time abroad, because they hold a passport, because they have frequent flyer miles and passport stamps, that does not make them culturally agile. I've seen so many people who've spent time living abroad who, frankly, are as closed-minded as when they were in their home country. Yet I've seen individuals who have never left their home country who have a curiosity and an openness and an interest in people who are demographically different. So I don't pass judgment on people without passports. I don't pass judgment on those who have, who boast about all the countries they've seen. I want to see, like, you know, show me that you're culturally agile, if you will. You know, show me
that
you really do.
Respect. You say that.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Well, tell me, how do we build our cultural agility? I mean, you have a lot of competencies in the book, a lot of things that we need to consider. But again, many of us, when you tell us that our brain makes us cognitively lazy when experiencing cultural novelty, and we find it hard to train ourselves to think because we're so comfortable with the customs and the mores that we've grown up around. And I think there's regional differences even in America, where if we begin to travel across the country, we're a little bit surprised and taken aback, and we feel a little bit uncomfortable at times going elsewhere and having to adjust or be more agile in relating to other people.
So regional differences is another great example of a socializing agent. You know, how one is socialized to behave, what's considered right, wrong, good, bad, professional, unprofessional, pretty, ugly. It's basically any situation that you walk into where a subjective judgment needs to be made, and you're making it based on, you know, you mentioned that lazy brain. You're basing it on the stored data that you have in your brain based on how you've been socialized throughout your life. So however old you are, you've been collecting data on how the world works, and that lazy brain is going to use that knowledge to interpret new situations. But we also have a signaling effect, and you described it. It was that, you know, feeling a little uncomfortable, feeling like something a little bit different. Anytime you get in that new situation, if you're around someone of a different generation, or you walk into a company for the first time that's unfamiliar to you, or you get off a plane in a new country, when it starts to feel different, it's signaling that you need to slow down that lazy brain. You need to assume your subjective impressions will be wrong. And that's when we need to kick in our curiosity and ask questions and be humble and all that other good stuff that we talk about in the book. But yeah, that brain of ours really does. It's wonderful when we understand the world that we're in, but boy, it really can do a number on us when we're out of our context.
Well, you also say that the brain is a good predicting machine in familiar settings, but it's a faulty predictor in novel settings. Explain what that means or how that is actually manifested through our behaviors.
I'll use the example. We have the greatest amount of data with our families. I mean, because presumably we were born into a family, we were raised by caregivers, by perhaps with siblings or aunts, extended family, we were raised in a neighborhood. In that setting, because you've had the greatest amount of data collected within your family, you know, for example, if your mother raised an eyebrow slightly, you would know exactly how to interpret that. You would know exactly what it meant. You would know exactly what was meant if your sibling did something. Like, there's just this familiarity where it's perfectly predictable because of the data. You know the context so well that the data is accurate. You know what things mean within your own organization that you have some tenure in. You know when you're with someone who is of your generation and you bring up, as you mentioned, that JFK reference, you have a common context for it. So the more similar and the more time individuals have had together and the more shared socializing agents they have, you know, again, whether it's location or company or profession or generation or whatever, the more of that in common, the more likely you can kind of rely on that lazy brain, because the probability is that you're seeing the world in through a similar lens.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that as an older guy these days, I don't like to think of myself as that, but I am. And generally, and I'm of the Jewish faith, there is something about running into another Jewish guy. It all feels so comfortable and familiar so quickly, almost as if all the cues and all the background, whether we're religious or not, and I'm not the most religious, but there's something culturally that feels very well worn and something that you feel that, well, you know where you are.
Sure. And the same is true. I'm an Italian American from the Northeast, raised in a blue collar context with a whole lot of education. If I run into a middle-aged white woman who's got that same background, I can kind of predict how she's seeing the world. Now, whether I'm accurate or not, it's right. So the more we project mm-hmm. into somebody else. Now, again, we have to test that, because it could be that person who seems demographically similar has had a vastly different background and upbringing and approach to the world and sees the world very differently. So I think we have to be careful how many overt cues that we take. I'll tell you, it gets us in trouble a bit when we're in cosmopolitan cultures around the world, because we start to get lulled into believing that, oh, look, that person is, you know, wearing the same watch or carrying the same handbag, or, you know, we're dressing more similarly. We speak a version of, you know, business English around the world. And it kind of lulls that brain back into believing that we can get comfortable. And those sort of overt signs are signaling, hey, similarity, when in fact those underlying values are still quite different. So we really do, you know, I guess with some of our examples, you know, it's okay to take that shorthand, but with others, you have to be a little careful.
Dr. Paula Caligiuri is with us, and she's an award-winning author, a distinguished academic, leading expert in the issue of cultural agility, and a lot of research goes into what it is that she's telling us today. And the whole idea that we can thrive in any country and with people from any culture really is not necessarily true if, in fact, we think that they should understand who we are without having to reciprocate and understand who they are. And you say that what makes us wildly successful in one culture, and let's take the American culture, where we're always forward moving, hard pushing, very active, very aggressive, positive in many ways, mm-hmm. can cause us to crash and burn in another.
As an American, we're both Americans, so I guess we can use it a bit as a shorthand and say, you know, for example, Americans tend to be very, very task-focused. So we tend to be, like you said, push it forward, performance-oriented, task-focused. Many cultures around the world are relationship-oriented. So before you can be trusted, before you can be considered credible, before you can be considered professional in many ways, you have to be trusted, and to be trusted, you have to build and take the time to build that relationship, whereas that's not considered particularly valuable. Show me what you've done. Show me your credentials. Show me who else you've worked for. Give me your references. It's a different approach. And there's several of these that manifest in ways that are that are different around the world that are sometimes hard for us to see. So
when you watch a summit between two leaders, recently there was one, President Biden and Vladimir Putin, and a lot of people do put much stock in the symbolism or the various ways that one approaches the other. Is that a fair thing to do? In other words, because we are such different cultures, and it's so important, the stakes, the symmetry, is that emblematic of what you're talking about? Not that scale, of course, but when we go to interact with a business associate in another culture.
Definitely. So if you think about any meetings of world leaders, all of those symbolic interactions are usually worked out ahead of time, who's standing where, who's positioned where, who's speaking first, because every single one of those will have a subjective meaning to their citizens at home or citizens or individuals around the world. So we have to, there's lots of experts in culture who work with world leaders to do those types of things. For us, we don't have that luxury. We don't have someone with us saying, okay, stand here, don't do this, shake hands, don't shake hands, you know. But yet, let me give one example that's very American, smiling. So I was taught as a little girl, I'll be 54 this month, so I was taught as a little girl, you know, to smile. So when my parents would say, what's wrong? Why aren't you smiling? What's wrong? Why aren't you smiling? Is everything okay? Why aren't you smiling? So I was, my natural default is to be smiley. In many cultures around the world, I have to be very careful to not use my default as smiling because it makes me look less credible. It makes me look less professional. It makes me look a little crazy. So, you know, something as simple as that, those little behavioral cues. Another one is silence. Americans have a tendency, which is typical, you know, you speak, I speak, you speak, I speak, you speak, I speak. Other cultures, there's a pause in between.
Mm.
And that pause to an American ear can sound like someone's not tracking or not really engaged. But not having the pause can be viewed as someone being kind of unengaged and disinterested. So it's really interesting. All these small things that we do send messages to other people's subjective brains. And so we hope that they're not using their lazy brains.
Well, you were talking about yourself as a woman. And
right.
When you go into a professional situation with somebody from another culture, is it more difficult for women than men to the extent that women in different cultures are treated differently? We're still working out a lot of the issues that in America have led to a glass ceiling and to a certain concerns, the whole Me Too movement. How about in other countries? How much are we supposed to, you know, gear up and know before we enter into one of these situations about the way their culture perceives, say, women?
We could spend 30 minutes just talking about this topic. It is so interesting. I used to joke, so I mentioned I'm in my 50s, but when I was younger, I used to joke that I could lose credibility in about 60% of the world just by showing up. because you know, as a woman, and I'd lose even more credibility if I shared what I shared with your audience, and that is that I'm a, you know, blue collar kid from Buffalo, New York. So this is not a, so what I've learned to do is to understand fairly deeply how I'm being perceived just on the physical, like how I'm showing up through the subjective lens of those with whom I'm interacting. Usually it's for keynotes or consulting or whatever. I try to work with the subjective lens of those with me. So for example, if I'm walking into a culture where the perception is that, you know, women aren't typically in leadership roles, I'll actually kind of play up my Americanness because there is an understanding globally that American women are in leadership roles. If, for instance, I'm in a culture where you're kind of born into your level, I do not say a word about my background. And if asked, I describe a very loving, smart family, and I tend to overplay my education. You know, so in some cultures, I don't talk about my education because they want to see what I've done. In some cultures, I talk only about my education because they want to know how I've been, you know, how I went up through the ranks on the educational front. So it's fascinating. And you just have to know, you know, kind of understand a little bit of the lens through which others are seeing you.
Well, you do remind us that every culture is different. And some national cultures are what you call tight. Others are loose. And how do you get all this information? If I'm going on a trip and I have to meet other business executives or educational executives, and I'm in education, or you are, for example, and say you wanted to meet peers across the world and really discuss this whole idea of cultural agility, how much preparation should I be doing, and what kinds of preparation to get ready? Say I'm going from Denmark to Japan. I mean, those are totally different worlds.
As part of this book, I was extremely fortunate, because you're right. We need to prepare ourselves. We need a little bit of understanding. I don't know if you know that the concept of selective perception. Some people have seen the whole moonwalking bear thing, that if you're looking at a situation and you're not expecting to see a moonwalking bear, you won't see it. I don't know if anyone's listening and hasn't seen it, YouTube moonwalking bear, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. You just don't see things that you're not expecting. So the idea is, raise your awareness on what you might see in another country, in another generation, in another profession, in another gender, in another whatever, right? Just raise your awareness, and then really use observational skills to see whether or not that's panning out. So what we've done, and I was very lucky that an angel investor who cares very deeply about intercultural relations invested in a company called Skillify, co-founded it with me, and we set it up as a public benefit corporation, basically to give this type of knowledge away for free. And it's been so wonderful. It was launched right around when the book was, you know, very recently. So please, if your listeners are interested, they're welcome to go onto the site. Again, it's 100% free. The tool is called MyGuide, so MyGiide.com. It's a free resource. They can go assess their own values, look up, you know, you mentioned Japan, look up, you know, how your values might differ from the Japanese ones, just as an awareness. It's not a stereotype. It's just, hey, be hypersensitive to what could be different, and you'll see it if in fact it is.
Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of people, I mentioned on another podcast, we were talking about the people of New York and New York as the indispensable city in America. And I said there are times, culturally, coming from Connecticut, where I'd get off the train to do business in New York, and I was overwhelmed immediately, the pace, the energy. And the city was not going to stop for me. It was just going to keep flowing like a river. And, you know, I tend to think the same way at times when I've been overseas, and I'm looking around and I'm saying, wow, I really don't know exactly what I'm in the middle of here. And you say that one of the great skills, and you break it down, three self-management competencies. And the one that I want to focus on for a moment, because I think you put a lot of stock and attention in it, is the tolerance of ambiguity. Mm-hmm. Now, that means that you really can't be a very closed-minded person and somebody who is fearful at every turn. You have to look at these things, take it all in with a wider aperture, and just accept that you may not understand this fully, but you've got to somehow embrace it. You're there. You're in the moment. So explain about this notion of tolerance of ambiguity.
So there's human variance on this, and it's interesting. It actually has a lot to do with the way our bodies handle dopamine. Like some people, you know, you put them in any situation, they miss their exit, they get really nervous, too much ambiguity. And then other people are like, oh yeah, I can get off the train, not know where I'm going, kind of muddle through. It's not going to affect me. It's not raising, you know, cortisol. It's not doing anything to strike that this is a situation for which I should be anxious or nervous or stressed. So we vary, humans vary on this. And it's really helpful to understand where you are on that spectrum. Because what ends up happening, if you go into a situation where there is a lot of ambiguity, what starts to happen is your brain, our brains, again, not only are they lazy, they absolutely want to get to comfort. They want to get to ease. They want to get to closure. They want to get to understanding. So basically what you start to do in order to kind of get out of that anxious state is you start interpreting the cues around you through the lens is your own. So people who have a very low tolerance to ambiguity, they try to close that ambiguity by creating kind of this false sense of clarity. And in doing so, they oftentimes get it wrong. So it's one of those competencies. It's a really helpful one to build out before doing something that requires a fair amount of novelty, you know, kind of gain the self-awareness. I just will mention really quickly on that same free site, you can also assess your competencies. So it's a really nice way to kind of understand your own, you know, meter yourself on these.
Well, let me get to the other competencies that are affiliated with the tolerance of ambiguity, and they are curiosity and resilience. So even if you enter into a situation that is ambiguous and you'd rather have more clarity, you have to kind of take from your reserve, be curious about what it is that you're experiencing, and then be resilient enough to overcome even a fear that is deeply held. You know, it may just be because you don't know, or you're placing such importance in this interaction, and yet you don't know whether the two of you or the five of you are really communicating effectively across these cultural bounds.
So if you can kick in your curiosity, okay, so you enter that situation, novelty, it's new, it's different, you can't quite, so you're getting off the train in New York, lots of stuff going on, you don't know which way you're going, which direction is north, south, whatever. The idea that people who are kind of faced with that much ambiguity can then start to ask questions more naturally. It's that recognition that the context that you're in is so important that you need some clarity to better understand the situation that you're going into. And that's where that curiosity kicks in. So we really, in the book, talk a lot about how do you build that out. Because again, just like tolerance of ambiguity, everyone has a natural level of curiosity. So we want to be able to build that out before going into any situation of novelty. Resilience, though, a little different. That is the assumption that things will go wrong, because they will. Whenever you're outside of your home context, whenever you're outside of a situation that's perfectly predictable, you are bound to make mistakes, and we have to be able to get comfortable, you know, working it through, laughing it off, shaking it off, and moving forward. I see a lot of very senior people who are so accustomed to being kind of in command of the room or in command of the situation really crumble under this, because they think that what they're doing should be having the same reaction as it would in a familiar context, and it doesn't. So both of those are
when we look at what's happened over the last year with the pandemic and a lot of people communicating by way of Zoom, and we are now told that this will make it easier for companies, many of whom in America do business in many different places with suppliers and with customers, and now that more employees are going to be hired from afar, because you really don't have to be as worried that somebody is long distance. People have become accustomed to it. That means more accommodation to different cultures, and often doing it without ever really truly meeting the person or stepping into their territory, staying in yours, but still having to negotiate that relationship.
I'm curious how this is going to unfold, Larry, because truthfully, I think situations, everything you said is 100% correct. It's wonderful that we now have the ability to look for great talent, regardless of where they might sit in the world, and all these wonderful things. However, in situations where, you know, trust is critical, in many parts of the world, the investment of time together is critical. And with sort of this efficient Zoom, we're scheduled 10 to 11, we're not buffering a lot of time in for getting to know each other. And I have a feeling that in situations where tremendous trust is needed, we're going to have to get a little more creative. And I don't mean like Zoom icebreakers. I mean really either, you know, setting up regularly scheduled meetings so there's kind of this sense of reliance on each other, being sensitive to each other's approaches to work and cues, and what does it mean to exchange information? What does a deadline mean? in different cultures? What does a communication pattern mean? So there are a lot of things. I think it's not technology. So many companies believe, yep, if we fix the technology, if we have all these great Zoom calls, we'll be able to work anywhere and with anyone. And then I think there are a few more steps in between. So I'm definitely out there talking about it's not always just the technology.
If only about 17% of the professional population has a high level of tolerance of ambiguity, how important, as a matter of course, with all the other skill sets that are being required in a highly technological age, with a lot of pace and a lot of pressure, is this a building of your cultural agility? Are corporations recognizing this as a trend, that this is not just fluff, this is not just a nice thing to do when we get to it, but that this is critical to our success?
I think there's an awareness that cultural agility is critical for leadership success. At the same time, I know there is a rampant lack of understanding of what that actually means. So many companies still believe that if you look at someone who has passport stamps, then that person must be culturally agile. And that's patently just not the case. So little by little, companies are starting to get to an understanding that we need those competencies and not just people who spend time on planes, not just, you know, individuals who happen to have had the family resources to study abroad when they were in college, or, you know, travel when they were young adults, that it really has more to do with competencies. And it's also not training. So many companies are relying on unconscious bias training and microaggression training and cross-cultural training. And, you know, and that's lovely. It's fine. But that too, you can't, I wish it was that easy. I wish we could go to a training session and build these competencies. We can't. They're things that require self-awareness and experience and practice.
Before we get outside of the country, we're looking now at a lot greater sensitivity to racial injustice within our companies, within our country, and trying to recognize where somebody has come from so that when you meet them in the same workplace, you have a shared ability to really understand each other and work together. And then, of course, even with the pandemic, we're seeing so many regional differences. We're seeing where vaccinations are accepted in the Northeast and the Pacific Northwest, but less so in the South. I mean, so it really does talk to us about schisms that we have that are pervasive, not just across borders, but even within our own country.
And Larry, it's exactly the reason you described. It's why I'm out there with every possible avenue kind of begging companies to stop all of this unconscious bias training, because what we're losing, what happens when, so basically what we do when we do unconscious bias training, its intention is good. It basically is introducing every human to their limbic system, that lazy brain of theirs that processes the world around them in a fraction of a second. We all have, for everyone with a healthy brain, we all have it. But because we've labeled it a bias, the backlash of it, you know, unintentionally, is that, well, I don't want to act with a bias. So I'm going to avoid a situation or a context or a conversation with someone where my bias might rear its ugly head. So what ends up happening is the very thing that would help close that schism, the very thing that would help us, you know, have authentic conversations with people of different races and different political affiliations and different whatever backgrounds, is authentic conversations with one another, human to human, finding that, oh, wow, you've got teenagers, so do I. Isn't it challenging? Oh, wow, you have an elderly parent, so do I. Isn't it? You know, or, wow, you've got a Basset Hound, so do I. You know, I mean, anything that connects us to each other is a human to human conversation, and kind of where I'm seeing a lot of between sort of what's happening, I think, unintentionally with the training, and also what's happening with filter bubbles and kind of the echo chambers that we're creating in social media, we're having fewer of those conversations. So, you know, that makes me nervous. It makes me nervous because, you know, hey, we're human, right?
It's just, yeah. I mean, Well, I think one of the things that you also point out, I talked about curiosity, but is humility in all of us. And admitting that I don't really understand some of this, and I really want to better understand this. I would imagine that if somebody's on a plane and somebody's going into meetings, and if they are walling themselves off from the real culture that exists within that environment, and they know just about the same amount about that country and the peoples who live within it, by the time they come back, maybe they get the sale, maybe they get the job done in the short term, but what have they gained, the person, about a greater understanding and a greater agility going forward when they put themselves in another cultural situation?
Yes. And I, you know what? It's interesting. There's sort of an inverse relationship with level in the organization that kind of has that awareness. So what ends up happening is senior most executives will go from, you know, interacting with other senior most executives who have been socialized quite similarly. They've gone to the same business schools. They've gone, you know, they've worked in the company for a long time. They've been socialized by the organization. They have sort of a level of affluence, so they've been socialized by a socioeconomic status. So they kind of get lulled into believing that things are going to be the same regardless of where they are in the world, right? And then what ends up happening is that when you watch them try to operate, they go from like a regional headquarters to a local subsidiary, and all of a sudden they're not being kind of as effective because the context is quite different. Fascinating kind of watching that I see almost better outcomes with people who are kind of dropped into situations where they go, okay, I need humility because everything I'm doing isn't working. You know, I might be brilliant in finance, accounting, you know, journalism, medicine, whatever, but I need some help to be effective here. And that's the kind of core of humility. Whereas those at the very senior levels are sort of buffered from that. And they tend not to have the developmental gain.
Well, let me admit my humility, perhaps not understanding all the situations that I've been thrown into over my lifetime, but trying my best to figure it out as I can. I have a long way to go. Build your cultural agility. The 9 competencies of successful global professionals. Paula Caligiuri has been with us, and I can't thank you enough. You're a great presenter, and I think you've basically explained to my audience something that they know intuitively is something that most of us are lacking, but I don't think they've given it enough consideration as we look at a world that is smaller and smaller by the day.
Absolutely. Well, Larry, thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Great to be with you. And by the way, if you want to give the name again of the organization and the information they can find there, that would be great.
Sure. Actually, I'll encourage all of your listeners to head over to this product. Like I mentioned, it's free, but it will give them the ability to assess their cultural values and compare those to different sort of average values in different countries, and also assess their competencies, those critical cross-cultural competencies, and learn how to build them. So the site is myguide.com, but the word guide is spelled G-I-I-D-E, so myguide.com.
Okay, terrific. And I wish you the best of success wherever your travels lead you, because I know you'll be in a better position to enjoy them and to make them successful, given your understanding of the importance of this agility that we've been talking about. So thanks again.
Thank you, Larry.